In this space, I've really adopted your language around this concept of energy expansion rather than transition. And I think that phrase perfectly describes Wyoming's role in today's energy systems. We truly are an all-the-above state. We're working to protect our legacy industries like coal and natural gas, oil and gas development, while we're pursuing all forms of new energy, wind, solar, hydrogen, nuclear. So it's a really exciting time to be in Wyoming generally, and specifically at the School of Energy Resources, where I was able to join a team of brilliant people that are working feverishly to ensure that Wyoming maintains its history of providing energy to the entire country.
You're listening to Energy Solutions, a podcast from the Electric Power Supply Association. I'm your host, Todd Snitchler. That was Kara Fornstrom, our guest for this episode. She's the director of the University of Wyoming Center for Energy Regulatory and Policy Analysis, or CERPA. Kara has also served as director of state regulatory policy for the Southwest Power Pool and is chair of the Wyoming Public Service Commission. Wyoming is the top coal-producing state in the United States. But like much of the country, the state is transitioning to new sources of energy as well. This comes as the region faces reliability challenges from heat, drought, and other factors. In this episode, Kara and I discuss how Wyoming and other Western states are balancing the growth of lower carbon power sources with the need for a reliable grid and continued economic growth. Kara also shared how the work she is spearheading at CERPA is shedding new, data-driven light on how to tackle those questions with lessons for the rest of the country. Thanks, Kara, for joining us today. And Kara, before we start, I want to just kind of cover the waterfront with you. You have had a lot of roles in your career, and I think it would be helpful for listeners to kind of know a little bit about your background and what those roles were so that they understand kind of the perspective you bring when we talk about energy-related issues.
Thanks, Todd. First, thanks for having me today. This is my first time on a podcast, so I hope this goes well for everyone. But my career has been a really interesting journey, one that I could not have predicted when I started out. I like to say that doors have opened for me that I didn't even know to knock on. My first part of my career was probably fairly traditional. I graduated from law school and joined the Attorney General's office in Wyoming. I was in the Water Division and got assigned to the Nebraska versus Wyoming litigation over the North Platte River. So I started my career on an original jurisdiction case in the United States Supreme Court. It was fascinating, a big team of experts and attorneys, and I got to be low man on the totem pole and just learned so much from all of them. And then after I left the AG's office, I co-founded a law firm that focused on water and natural resource issues. Did that for about 13 years before I was approached by Governor Meade for an appointment to the Public Service Commission, for which I'm embarrassed to say I knew nothing about. But he was very patient with me and stuck with me anyway and appointed me the commission, served 6 years under him, and then got reappointed by Governor Gordon in 2019. I became chairman of the commission at that time. So I left in January of 21. I served 8 years at the commission. And I left to join SPP, where I was director of regulatory affairs, mostly focused on the Western expansion efforts. And then in December of last year, I joined the School of Energy Resources at the University of Wyoming, where I'm the director of the Center for Energy Regulation and Policy Analysis. Our mission at SER is energy-driven economic development for Wyoming, which informs everything we do. And I think really is a great opportunity for me to combine these various aspects of my professional career to date.
Sure. And a full disclosure, Kara and I met when we were both commissioners. I was still at the Ohio Commission and Kara was at the Wyoming Commission. And your 8 years on the commission is almost three times longer than the average service of a typical commissioner. So you really had a deep level of experience at the commission, which I think really is part of your inherent value and what you do now and what you did for SPP. So how would you explain to stakeholders and entities that operate in the eastern half of the country how to think about energy and the energy system and the energy evolution that's clearly underway from more of a Western perspective? And then if you want to add the Wyoming flavor, certainly that'd be helpful too.
So the phrase, the West is different, is one I've been hearing since I joined the commission, especially as it relates to electricity markets. That notion became more obvious to me when I joined SPP and had the task of applying the well-established processes of SPP in the Eastern Interconnection to new entities that may not have been familiar with them in the Western Interconnection. Some say the reason that the West has been slower on these market development issues is because of our independent culture. And I think there may be some truth to that. But I do believe all the efforts that are going on right now are leading the West to organize in a different way, one that will look different than Eastern interconnection markets, but should capture many of the benefits of those markets, such as regional transmission planning and obviously more efficient dispatch of generation and transmission facilities.
Yep. Which I think will drive into questions about cost, which I'm sure we'll get to. So
Kara, I think Wyoming sometimes gets stereotyped or is something of a caricature of what is and what isn't. So as the only native of Wyoming on this podcast, I was hoping you'd give listeners a view of all that Wyoming represents in the energy space and maybe how that fits in with all the things you're working on.
I'll start with the things that your listeners probably know about Wyoming. We're the largest coal producer in the country, producing 40% of the nation's coal. We currently export to about 23 states, which is down from 40, probably 15 years ago. Coal is also our largest electricity resource. 71% of our generation is now coal, but that's down from 97% in 2003.
Wow.
Wind makes up the other big portion of that, 22%. We do have some hydro and gas generation. We do have some of the historically lowest rates in the country, but we're an extractive state of other resources as well. Oil and gas, uranium, trona, helium. And in fact, we produce 13 times more energy than we consume.
Wow.
So the mineral industry really is the backbone of our state, which is illustrated by our permanent mineral trust fund, which currently has a balance of about $10 billion. So moving to things that your listeners may not know, Wyoming's been in the carbon management business for a very long time. We've led the country on statutory and regulatory framework for carbon capture. And in fact, when SDR was founded in 2006, we brought in the Carbon Management Institute. And we really received the direction from our last two governors, both Governor Mead and Governor Gordon, who've made the distinction between the commodity and the emissions. So we've been really focused on reducing emissions. And I'll give you just a couple of examples of that. We're one of the country's leaders in carbon safe projects funded by the DOE. And we have industrial partners on all of those. Which are permanent sequestration opportunities. We have our newest award is in the Sweetwater Hub, which will be for the trona industry. That's currently in negotiations with DOE. But we have a phase three project in Northeast Wyoming near Dry Fork Station. And that project has led to us filing some of the first class six well applications in the state of Wyoming. We're one of only two states that has class six primacy. And so we're looking forward to getting some of those applications granted and moving forward on that. Also at Dry Fork Station is the Integrated Test Center, and that really focuses on CO2 utilization. It's a public-private partnership where 25 megawatts of flue gas is diverted to test bays, and we have different technologies that are being tested there, some small vendors and also a large one that are testing their technologies related to membranes and sorbents. So we also have some legislative initiatives underway to really encourage carbon capture on a coal plant. And we see that really as a twofold benefit for Wyoming. We can preserve our affordable, reliable electricity and maintain those jobs and property tax benefits. But we can also export that technology to other states who are using Wyoming coal and preserve those plants as well. So in Wyoming, we believe in producing energy here instead of elsewhere in the world because it leads to less environmental impacts. Because we really know how to balance energy production with sound stewardship practices.
I think a lot of what you said might surprise folks about how broad and the depth of the exposure, not just to the things that people go, oh yeah, it's Wyoming. I would expect they'd be coal and gas, but that was a pretty extensive list of other things you're working on.
So more broadly, how do you view the future of nuclear power and where does Wyoming fit in that whole puzzle, whether it's large reactors or small modular or providing the feedstock, kind of where do you see that and where do you see Wyoming headed?
You know, Wyoming really is kind of a boom and bust state given our extractive industry background. And that's probably not more true for any industry than uranium mining. that's seen some booms and busts over the years. We do have several firms that are actively engaged in uranium mining. They're seeing an uptick. And so we're looking for some positive results from our mining industry as well. But what we're most excited about, I think, right now is the announcement of the Terra Power Project in Kemmerer, Wyoming. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on around that. But one of the projects that I'm working on at CERPA is a series of six white papers on the integrated nuclear industry and what pieces of that value chain make sense to house in Wyoming. We're obviously engaged in the nuclear electricity production, mm-hmm. but we're also looking at uranium processing, small modular manufacturing, mining, recycling, disposal, as well as other industrial applications. One of our newest centers at the School of Energy Resources is the Nuclear Energy Research Center, and we're getting a lot of financial support both within the state and from the federal government to develop that program. We're developing curriculum at SER and at community colleges to develop that workforce so that it's ready for TerraPower.
Awesome.
So I would say it's an all hands on deck approach when it comes to nuclear, something that's pretty new to us, really, but we're pursuing every aspect of that that we can.
Great. Can you back up just for a second and kind of explain the TerraPower project for those that may not be familiar?
It's a small modular project. And for me, one of the great things about the project is where it's going to be located, which is in Kemmerer, Wyoming, which is a community that has a coal mine and a mine-to-mouth plant adjacent that had three units.
Mm-hmm.
Unit three of Naughton had been converted to gas a few years ago, and unit one and two are likely to convert to gas as well. But that was a project that Rocky Mountain Power had identified as an early closure unit.
Got it.
And I remember going to Kemmerer a few years ago when that IRP was released, and I'm telling you, it was one of the longest nights of my life. Mm. It was just so difficult to hear residents talk about the devastating impacts that the closure of that plant would have on them.
Mm-hmm.
I think the figures are something like between the coal mine and the coal plant, it's about 85% of that county's property base, property tax base. So it was devastating. So for TerraPower to come in, it makes sense from a transmission perspective. The company already owns the land. There's good transition for workers from the coal plant to the nuclear plant. Mm-hmm. And I was in Kemmerer last week, and I'm happy to report the entire tone of the community has completely changed from when I was there 4 years ago. There's a palpable buzz around town about that project and some others. And so I think that's what's been most exciting, is to see the turn of events of a coal plant that mm-hmm. was proposed to be closed early and to find a new opportunity for that community and in the nuclear industry.
That's great. We may come back to you in the future and get regular updates on what may be going on there. So you've talked a little bit already about some of the work that you're doing at the university and the program that you kicked off, and in fact, have started from scratch. This seems to be a thing that you do repeatedly now. There was the law firm, you learned the regulator business, now you're learning the academic business. And I know you mentioned some of the research that you're doing, and there's already some work that's been done, and I know you've got other things in the pipeline. Can you talk a little bit about how you go about doing that and what you're focused on at the moment? I know you're chasing a lot of things, but there's a few core things that you're probably spending most of your time on. Kind of fill us in a little bit about what that is and how you hope that information can be used.
Sure. Before I get into maybe the specifics of that, I'll give you a little bit of backdrop on what School of Energy Resources
Great.
Is. One of my favorite sayings is, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
Mm-hmm.
And that's never been a problem for me in my career, but it's the least problem I've had in this setting. I'm just surrounded by really brilliant people, a lot mm-hmm. of PhDs who have spent their lives really immersed in these topics. So SER has three main components. We have an academic function, a research function, and outreach function. And we're seeing significant growth in all three of those areas. Our academic program is highly interdisciplinary, mm-hmm. and it involves collaboration with the College of Engineering, College of Agriculture, College of Business, the Hobbs School of Environment and Natural Resources, our College of Law, and many others. Our primary function at SER is our research function,
mm-hmm.
which is primarily funded by the state of Wyoming, but also competitive research grants. We've been awarded $80 million in the last year alone, which is leading to a lot of our growth. We collaborate with industry partners on mm-hmm. most of those grants, And as I said, we're really organized around centers of excellence. So we have a center for geological research, center for carbon capture and conversion, hydrogen center. And then we have other centers across campus that are led in those different departments, like the Wind Energy Research Center, the Nuclear Energy Research Center, which I mentioned, Center for Air Quality, and a Center for Produced Water Management. So we really are addressing all aspects of the energy industry through these centers. And that really allows us to organize our research around the most critical and emerging topics in energy. So CERPA, which is the center that I direct, we work across all of our centers and try to identify those policy and regulatory issues that may rear their ugly heads as these innovative technologies are developed. And I think the best example I have for that is maybe in the hydrogen space. When we start talking about hydrogen pipelines, you know, who's going to permit those? And once we decide that, what are the permitting parameters going to be around those pipelines? Do we need additional safety measures than perhaps we've had for oil and gas pipelines? So how would we go about that? And in my view, we can provide a competitive advantage in Wyoming if we have all of that streamlined and identified before the first application arrives.
That's really some leading edge kind of work that you're leaning into, because the, of course, DOE has a number of hydrogen hubs that they are looking to support. And it's clearly one of the issues that has a lot of attention. It's kind of the new thing. And I think people have overlooked some of the practical things that I think you're looking to try to address on the front end. So having some model legislation or model safety related issues, that sounds like a fantastic place to start, because it will help accelerate some of this stuff as we go forward. So I like the practical, because sometimes people get concerned about academics that we're researching things that, you know, so what becomes the answer. But this is a real world. Like, if you want to make it happen, these are some of the things you're going to need. So Kara, it sounds like you are working on a lot of things in your new role. Can you walk us through what some of your top projects are?
Yes, we have a lot of exciting projects going on at CERPA specifically. I've talked about some of the other centers, but at CERPA, we're going to be soon publishing a paper on social license for Wyoming's energy future. Really interesting, because it captures both qualitative and quantitative data from Wyoming residents to determine how they feel about different aspects of energy development in our state. And that data has been really critical to inform our outreach efforts for educational purposes, as well as our ability to demonstrate that Wyoming remains a state proud of its history as a national energy leader and its willingness to embrace these new technology and opportunities. And we're finding a lot of places to be able to use that on other projects. We're also working on papers about hydrogen opportunities in Wyoming, regulation of pore space for permanent CO2 storage, where Wyoming is set in terms of our leadership on statutory and regulatory frameworks compared to perhaps our federal partners in our neighboring states. We're looking at a paper on, we're working on a paper on regulatory options for rate treatment of carbon capture facilities on utility-owned coal units. I mentioned the nuclear series and the reliability series, but we have a pipeline of research topics that we get from engaging with stakeholders and the policy support issues. We have so many topics and so little time, as they say, but we are going to be producing a lot of different papers on various aspects of what's going on in Wyoming.
Are you taking additional work items? Because we could probably come up with a handful of things we might throw your way.
Absolutely. That's what we like to have. We like to have our ear to the ground, know what people like to, what they need to have some information about, and we put our team on it.
Great. Be careful what you wish for. So I'll say one of the issues that we're facing in the East, and I'm not sure where you are, perhaps in Wyoming, but is issues around resource adequacy. And it's a real issue. It's not restricted to restructured markets. SPP and MISO have talked about resource adequacy issues as well. And there's challenges of different varieties. So how are you focusing any of your work on issues about making sure that we have sufficient resource adequacy to keep the lights on and do it cost effectively? Is that an area that you're focusing on, or is that something that you think needs attention or needs more attention? Or nah, we've got it handled. You can move on to your next question. We're good.
So I have this paradigm I've witnessed in my own life. I think it came from Oprah or something, but basically if you're on the wrong track, you know, you get a little whisper in your ear. If you don't pay attention to that, you maybe get a tap on your shoulder. If you don't get that one, maybe a big slap on the back. And finally, if you're still not paying attention, you get a brick over the head. And that's really the best analogy I can come up with where I think we are in reliability, or what's going on with reliability. And I'm not really sure where we are on the spectrum of that. I think we're certainly past whispering in the ear.
Yeah.
But even though it's not my job anymore, I really do worry about the brick. And so I do spend a lot of time thinking about reliability. You and I have had a lot of conversations about that. One of the things that we're doing at SERPA, we've launched a reliability series, which will be a series of white papers on a regular basis. I've been reluctant to commit to an actual time frame on that, but I'm working on the first one, which really is exploring the new vocabulary around resource adequacy, how the traditional standard of 1 in 10 doesn't seem to be working,
right?
And introducing the reader to new methodologies and metrics being considered, such as expected unserved energy, including energy adequacy in the equation, effective load carrying capability. So the initiatives underway across the country, I think, really demonstrate the need to be thinking of resource adequacy as expanding rather than transitioning. It's clear that baseload resources are still very much needed to support the grid. And I think it's causing some rethinking about reliability attributes of various generation resources and the pace of integration of intermittent resources. So I think there's a lot going on in that space, and SERPA plans to be, I monitor it probably daily, and I plan to, SERPA plans to be engaged in the research piece of exploring different components of that on a regular basis.
If we can throw one more research topic on the top of your pile, I would add the expansion or the change to planning parameters is something that probably needs a little bit of investigation. We're using the same planning parameters that were, you know, developed in the 1950s, and we're not in the 1950s anymore. So that would be one of the things I certainly from EPSA's perspective that we're focused on. And I know NERC is focused on, does there need to be a change in that? Are we using the, as you note, the wrong measuring stick? Because if you're measuring the wrong things, you're going to end up at the wrong outcome. So I think that work will be incredibly helpful.
And maybe so, one more quick point on that. Yeah. I think the planning parameters are something that we're looking at. This paper also looks at the various reasons that the 1 in 10 is no longer working. And as we start looking into that, there are more than two or three of those.
Yeah.
And the other piece of this paper that I think will be interesting for people, I think we're pretty focused on the reliability conversation about load shedding events. But reliability isn't just about load shedding.
That's
it's
right.
about having to dispatch really expensive resources in times of tight supply. It has a lot of different impacts than load shed. And so I think we need to expand what we think about when we think about a reliable grid.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, everybody thinks about those 5 or 10 days a year when it's super cold or it's super hot and the system's got to work. But those aren't the only days that the system's under stress. And I think as we see weather changing and as we see the impacts of hotter temperatures, that means that maybe your shoulder months aren't, when you do your maintenance on your equipment, aren't going to work like they used to. So how do you manage through some of the practical, back to your point about some of the practical things that you're looking at, that requires changing how we think about some of the ways we've done things for the better part of 100 years are going to have to be altered in order to make sure that we ensure reliability. So I love that you're broadening it to make it a bigger question that we have to look at. So you're too modest to say it, but I count you as my expert on Western power issues. So I'm curious how you are viewing the issues around the Western RTO. You talked about it a little bit with your role at SPP, but you know, it seems to be taking a different track in order to get from the beginning to execution than maybe some of the Eastern markets did. So I know Scott Miller has been on and talked with us a little bit about this. I know you know Scott, but I'm always interested in a variety of opinions because I'm sure everybody's got their own view about how it goes. How do you see things happening? How does Wyoming fit into some of this, both as an energy producer and an energy consumer in the value chain? How are you thinking about that? And where do you think it is on the path from starting to getting to resolution?
I will push back on the term expert. Of course, I don't think that's accurate.
You're still too modest, but okay.
I have been watching this for the past 10 years or so, and I am pretty excited about where we're moving in the Western Interconnection. To me, the most positive and encouraging sign that we've had in this process is the successful launch of the Western Resource Adequacy Program. And it's not a market, but what it does demonstrate for the first time is entities across the West coming together to do something on a regional basis. We have had so many stops and starts and failed attempts to do anything like this. And I really believe the success of regional cooperation will spill over to this next phase for market evolution. And so I'm not sure they get enough credit, everyone involved in that effort, to really breaking through that barrier, which I think is critical for us to make any progress on market development.
Can you tell me what drove that? Because this feels like it's a very bottom-up process in the West, not a top-down, like there's no they out there who are driving this, but it's coming from the bottom. Can you kind of, how's that work? I mean, how did it come together? And is it still a bottom-up process that's evolving in a functional direction?
I think that's a fair assessment of how it developed. To me, it's really a demonstration of the urgency people feel around resource adequacy, even when they're not in a market, how important that is. I will tell you, as a former regulator, when I was there, our utility would come in and say, whatever we can't generate on ourselves, we're going to get through front office transactions.
Right.
But we had very little transparency into what that looked like. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a general realization across the West that everyone was sort of relying on the same bucket of front office transactions.
Right.
And so while there's not a market here, there are two phases of this program. There's the forward showing, which is obviously longer term, and then there's the operational. And it really makes those resources available in our traditional bilateral market in the West when you have times of short supply.
Yeah.
But it's also trying to get some standard accreditation across different resources. Yep. And there are different zones for wind, for example. Wind in Wyoming is different than wind in Oregon.
Yep.
And how those resources are being accredited so they can get a more accurate picture of what resources will be available when they're needed. And so it really was, I think, an organic effort amongst entities who were seeing some real concerns on the horizon about how they were going to get through this. Regulators have certainly supported that effort, and the governance model has been very inclusive of regulators in that process. And so I think it's just been a really positive development. The entities that are involved in that project, however, are pursuing perhaps different market solutions, which we can talk about in a minute, which will be interesting to see how that works in conjunction with those two markets that are developing. But it's really been just a great process, I think, from all aspects, the governance direction, the bringing together, the standardization of some accreditation issues, and all of those things.
So this issue has come up a handful of times and a bunch of different ways we've kind of talked around it, but haven't talked about it directly. So I'll ask you for your candid opinion about how we resolve some of the state federal tension around resource choices and mandates, state policy choices, and how the impacts that they have on other state policy choices, how this plays into the development of a market in the West, how it's impacting markets that exist in the East, and some of the challenges that we're facing, we as EPSA are facing, but also as a portion of the country that's trying to figure out how to avoid maybe some of the pitfalls that have been identified in other spots. How do you see resolution of some of this state federal tension?
It's a really difficult question. And I probably will start a little bit from the Wyoming perspective. Mm-hmm. We're no stranger to this, as we've, our coal industry has really been under constant assault for about 20 years. And the impacts of that economically have been devastating to portions of our state. I think things have sort of stabilized at the level that they are for the moment. But ideally, it would be great if we could go back to this concept of cooperative federalism. Not really.
Emphasis on cooperative.
Right. Where, states had a role, federal government had a role, and everybody sort of respected that, in its pure state. Having said that, I'm not optimistic that we're headed back to that anytime soon. And so we have these constant, a lot of things that SERPA does is we try to help on policy support with the governor's office and the Wyoming Energy Authority on responding to proposed rules. I'll talk about oil and gas for a minute. BLM, well, the federal government owns 50% of the state of Wyoming, much of it in a checkerboard fashion, which makes transmission construction quite difficult through a permitting process. But also they control a lot of our ability to develop our mineral resources. And so we're constantly responding to these new proposed rules from the federal government about limitations or different practices. And so we've adopted a pretty aggressive approach about that and trying to push back and provide the facts for the record so that they can make a more reasonable decision in our view. So I don't know what the answer is. I think it's a huge problem, and it certainly is causing a lot of significant issues in my state.
Well, on that optimistic note, I will ask you maybe a question that will allow your optimism to come through. So what do you see happening over the energy space in the next decade? Where are the opportunities that you think energy has to be really vital in, you know, the next decade or so?
Again, really difficult to predict, but it's great to be part of an organization, the School of Energy Resources, where our mission is very clear, and it's the energy-driven economic development for Wyoming. So I know here we have the right people engaged across all of state government, obviously at the School of Energy Resources, great staff at the governor's office, the Wyoming Energy Authority, the Business Council, other state agencies. And we're really blessed to have the financial support of our legislature and the governor's office. So I suspect, given all the different things that we're chasing, we're going to find some surprises in the work that we're doing in every aspect of the energy industry. And I can't really predict with any accuracy how that's all going to shake out. But I do know that we're working as hard as we can and as fast as we can to maintain Wyoming status as an energy producing state.
I will close with one final question. If there's one thing that you could fix or that you could change to help improve how you see where we stand in the energy space, what would it be, or what would you change?
In my view, the most important thing that could change and provide the most significant progress is if we could get some regulatory certainty from the federal government. We're seeing big swings from administration to administration on these really critical issues. And in my view, it's chilling long-term investment. It's preventing innovation for baseload resources specifically. And so I'm not overly optimistic that we're going to get that. But I, if I could change anything, it would be that the federal government recognizes that how important regulatory certainty is for the investment of the kind of resources they're expecting for us to continue, you know, to progress in the energy industry.
Yeah, and I think that's true across the entire energy value chain. Our members are similarly situated. You don't make a 20 or 30 year investment decision on a 2 or 4 year election cycle. It makes it impossible to deploy capital in a way that makes it make sense for investors, shareholders, or ratepayers, depending on your model. So anything that we have missed, Kara, that you want us to know about Wyoming or about the school or about the work that you're doing?
I think it's easy reading headlines and going through all the things that we all read in the industry that we're in to get pretty down on where we are and where we're headed. But I remain an optimistic person. And I just feel really blessed to be working at SER, where everyone is enthusiastically focused on Wyoming's energy future. It's part of our blood. It's part of our proud history. And I'm really excited about the work that we're doing. And we're determined to continue to play a role in the national efforts related to energy.
Well, we will count on seeing those resources and how we might be able to use them to help make good energy policy decisions here in Washington. So, Kara, I can't thank you enough for joining us. I really appreciated your time. And always, as always, enjoy the conversation.
Thanks so much, Todd.
You can learn more about CERPA at www.uwyo.edu. And as always, follow along for competitive power news and updates at epsa.org. Thanks for listening to Energy Solutions. If you like this episode, please share it on social media or with your coworkers, friends, and family. You can also connect with us on X, formerly Twitter, at EPSA News, and on LinkedIn, and on Threads at Electric Power Supply. And subscribe, follow, leave a rating, or comment on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Pandora, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Energy Solutions is brought to you by the Electric Power Supply Association. EPSA represents America's competitive power suppliers, which bring about 150,000 megawatts of power generation resources to customers throughout the United States. Discover the power of competition at www.epsa.org.